From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Mark Twain was the first great American celebrity, the first great American comedian. He was on the Mississippi for the golden age of steamboating, in the East as the rough-hewn voice of the American West, and in the world as the acerbic genius and avatar of America's 19th century rise to power. As Twain biographer Ron Powers says, Samuel Clemens had an uncanny knack for being in on the cultural big bangs of his time, with a voice that keeps on ringing. In his new biography of this American great, Powers acquaints readers intimately, perhaps more intimately than ever before, with the remarkable life of Mark Twain, the triumphs and tragedy of the man who gave America its voice, his rambunctious humor, his unruly anger, his biting politics, his incomparable prose. This hour on Point, the life of Mark Twain and the great flood of his genius. You can join the conversation. What is it that still, today, makes Mark Twain speak so deeply, so bitingly to and for Americans? And can you imagine Riverman Mark Twain on Katrina and her aftermath? Humorist Mark Twain on George Bush? Philosopher Mark Twain on our adventure in Iraq? What's your great Twain book or passage? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from a studio at Middlebury College in Middlebury, Vermont, is Ron Powers, author of Flags of Our Fathers, Heroes of Iwo Jima, Tom and Huck Don't Live Here Anymore, and the big new biography, Mark Twain, A Life. Ron Powers, thanks for being with us.
Hi, Thomas. Good to be here.
And joining us from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly. Jack, great to have you.
Hello, Tom, and hello to our guest.
I want to start right off just evoking the spirit of Mark Twain, if we may, with the voice of Hal Holbrook. Here he is from Mark Twain Tonight, his one-man show about Twain, with Twain reminiscing about his days as a reporter in Washington, D.C.
When I was putting together my first book, I did a stretch in Washington as a newspaper correspondent. And every day I went over to the Congress, that grand old benevolent national asylum for the helpless. And I reported on the inmates there. It is very entertaining. I had never seen a body of men with tongues so handy and information so uncertain. Well, they could talk for a week without ever getting rid of an idea.
Tongue so handy and information so uncertain. Ron Powers, it still flows right through there. There's so much we want to talk about the life of Twain, and it seems so relevant at this moment. But take us first to just this big issue of what makes Twain the American voice. What is it about him, his work?
Well, I think, Tom, that one of the things he did that broke off one American voice and started another, which really became our national voice that we still use to this day to some extent. He really interrupted that transcendentalist note of high diction and polite literature, which honestly produced some wonderful works through Emerson and Longfellow and Hawthorne and Holmes. These guys were important to American letters, but even though they themselves, especially Emerson, were calling for a new American voice in the mid-19th century, they couldn't tear themselves away from that old European, that received European sense of polite discourse and polite literature, very shapely, very formed, very meditated, mediated beforehand. Sam Clemens went out west to sit out the Civil War. Mm. And while he was out there, he fell in with a bunch, having failed as a miner and a speculator. He always failed as a businessman, thank God, or he wouldn't have his literature. Right. He fell in with a bunch of people, young newspaper men. I almost think of them as proto-hippies in Nevada. They really were a counterculture of sort of visionary drifters who fetched up around the Comstock lode where all the gold and silver was flowing out. And the point is that in their newspaper writings for a little tiny paper called the Territorial Enterprise,
yes,
they basically broke all the rules because there wasn't anybody to look over their shoulder. There wasn't Emerson to wag his finger and say, no, no, you're not being polite. They poured wildness and tall tales and hoaxes into the newspaper and practical jokes on one another. And it was all a reflection of the wildness of the territory that they were in, and the bluntness and the ability to describe terrain, and to describe these vivid voices.
And came busting out with this American vernacular that was by no means a slave to Europe. It was the opposite. It was original. It was as rough as the land they were living in.
That's right. Exactly right. And of course, if Sam Clemens was one thing, he was, I keep using the word mimetic, he could reproduce sounds, he could reproduce voices, he could reproduce literary styles, and he heard what was going on around him, including the tall tales that he eventually fed into the Jumping Frog story, the tall tale that ended all tall tales.
Calaveras,
yeah. And he brought this back east with some trepidation, because part of him wanted to join that Eastern aristocracy, especially after he fell in love with a daughter of it, and the other part of him delighted in firing harpoons into its flank. So one of the great dilemmas of his life was how much of that wild Western voice to keep and how much of it to hold back on.
You've got this absolutely delicious moment that you open the book with. I wish you'd share it with us. This mid-November afternoon in 1869, when Samuel Clemens comes sauntering into Boston, then the Holy of Holies, the home of this high American culture, still indebted to Europe. We should paint that scene for us and what transpired there, Ron Powers.
Well, it's a wonderful moment in his life because he's still practically got the sagebrush clinging to his overcoat from the West.
How old is he still, here? 1869, he'd be 34?
He is 34. Mm-hmm. And he's back from the Civil War is over. He's back. He's been in lecturing in Hawaii. He's lectured in San Francisco. And now he's followed the fame of the Jumping Frog back east. And he's on a lecture tour, and he's walking along Tremont Street in Boston. And he's passing by all of these wonderfully refined gentlemen and the women in their brocaded brooches. I guess brooches aren't brocaded. But he turns into a bookstore. Tickner and Fields, and he climbs to the second floor. He climbs the staircase to the second floor, knocks on the door, and he's at the offices of the Atlantic magazine. And he's there to see a fellow who gave his new book, Life on the Mississippi, a very very rapturous review, and very unusual because the Atlantic didn't usually review this kind of book, a travel book sold by scruffy subscription guys going around from door to door. The guy he's there to meet is William Dean Howells, and that moment of their meeting really an electric lightning bolt must have formed over the continent because these two men together would form a great friendship that would be productive in terms of literary achievement. Howells welcomed Sam and really ushered Sam across the threshold.
It's an amazing moment. You make it so personal and intimate. Here's this red-haired, we think of him as the great sage with the white locks later, but the red-haired Samuel Clemens with his rolling kind of sauntering Western gait, not the Boston style. And this little guy with his hair, parted down the middle in William Dean Howells, in the heart of American abolitionism, the Transcendental Movement, the Atlantic Monthly in its youth. And he's come all the way to Boston to seek out this paragon of that world, Samuel Clemens has, because he's so thrilled to have been acknowledged.
Exactly. And Howells rises from his desk to his full height of 5'6". And, of course, Sam is taller than him at 5'8". And Howells is this dutiful, solemn. He himself is a fugitive from Ohio. But he has worshipped at the feet of the Transcendentalist. And he's an apostle of high literature. And yet there's something in him that recognizes this bold new voice. And so here he is, plump. He's got his walrus mustache and his fastidious little coat and tie. Mm. And Sam looks at him and said, "When I read that review of yours, I felt like the woman whose baby had come white."
woman who had had some doubt whether it was going to come this way or that.
Exactly.
And it came out the way she hoped.
Howells picked himself up off the floor, I guess, and let that go, as Mark Twain would say. And that was the beginning of a beautiful 40-year friendship. Good for them, good for the national letters.
Jack Beatty, there it is, Mark Twain, offensive, right in the face of the abolitionist stronghold there. Off-color joke, his first comment to William Dean Howells. And he would continue to wag that kind of Western mentality and ride it to incredible success for the rest of his life.
He would. He's the great manifestation of the red skin in American literature. Philip Roth once divided American writers between pale faces and red skins. And his fellow Missourian, T.S. Eliot, is the archetypal pale face. And the red skin note of here's the West, here's my heart in all its crudeness, here's my stream of consciousness, that was a new note in the Atlantic, certainly, and in all of our culture. And really, with Twain, we finally get down to it, the Americanness of American literature. There it is. That's the note.
And all these years later, he's still striking that true note, with all of its sort of glory, but also the bitterness that emerged over his lifetime.
Yes, he is, and he's striking it notably about the Philippine War, the seizing of the Philippines so hard on the heels of the liberation of Cuba. And that is the Mark Twain, it seems to me, who speaks most to us today, who mourns what's happened to the country in this lurch, this sordid lurch for loot and empire.
Ron Powers, stand by. We've got to take a short break here, Mr. Powers. We'll come right back. We want to get all of your views. We want to learn a lot more about this wonderful life of Mark Twain. Ron Powers, author of the new biography, Mark Twain, A Life. You can join this conversation. Can you imagine Mark Twain on Katrina and her aftermath? What is it that still makes him speak to Americans today? 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the great flood of Mark Twain's genius, the truly all-American life of Samuel Clemens, with the author of his new biography, Mark Twain, A Life, Pulitzer Prize-winning writer Ron Powers. He joins us from Middlebury, Vermont this hour. Jack Beatty's with us as well. You can join us. Do you really know the life, often tragic, behind the great American humorist? And what do Americans see in the mirror held up by Mark Twain? What is Mark Twain's America? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Ron Powers, you grew up in Hannibal yourself, like Mark Twain, or spent some time there, and yet resisted writing a biography for a long time, even though you've written about Mark Twain. Why now? Why this book? Justin Kaplan wrote, of course, the big one, Mr. Clemens and Mark Twain, 40 years ago now. Why a new biography?
Well, I think I resisted it, Tom, partly because I grew up in Hannibal and was hyper aware of the man and his reputation from very early childhood. I could see him on the back of produce trucks. I could go to movies at the Tom Sawyer Theater and I could take a ride on the Tutu Twain. So I guess I grew up running away from him. He was so big, and there has been so much written about him over the nearly 100 years since his death. And I guess I felt that everybody in the country was sort of looking at me and saying, well, you're from Hannibal. When are you going to do it? And when I finally decided that I would do it and try to add something new, when I started looking into the literature that had already been written about him, I discovered that just about everything that could be written about Mark Twain has been written except the life itself. The earliest biographer outside of Paine, who knew him in his lifetime, Albert Bigelow Paine, the first independent biography in 1920 by Van Wyck Brooks was called The Ordeal of Mark Twain. Van Wyck Brooks was a great critic who had read a magazine article about Sigmund Freud and thought, wow, that's pretty interesting, and analyzed Clemens along the template of Freudian theory. And that set the tone for, the ensuing biographies. I think Justin Kaplan's work was magnificent, but it was a psychobiography. And then came the 80s with the deconstructive movement, and Sam became the great white male. So there's been this tendency to diagnose him, to look for his, the words you see on the bookshelves, his evasions, his duplicities, his subversions. And meanwhile, the life, this epic sweep that spanned the continent, that spanned the globe, that began with the adult life. He heard Charles Dickens lecture on his first evening out with his future wife. By the end of his life, he had introduced Winston Churchill to his first American audience, played miniature golf with Woodrow Wilson.
You're right, yes.
Yeah, so the life itself, and I was helped in this immeasurably by a wonderful archive out at the University of California at Berkeley called The Mark Twain Project. This is a bunch of seven or eight researchers who signed on 25, 26, 27 years ago as graduate assistants and still have not stopped collating and annotating and footnoting the letters that came to him and from him. There are now something like 12,000 of those in print. I could use those letters and his notebooks and journals almost as a novelist would use dialogue, without violating the terms of truth at all. This immersion in the letters sort of enabled me, and I hope the reader, to walk alongside him and see how he thought, and we can make up our own minds whether he was subversive or duplicitous or evasive. And you find after a while it sort of fades away because there are so many other important things about him to understand.
He was unbelievably prodigious as a letter writer, you know.
He was. 12,000 have been collected. Some researchers think that there were 50,000 written in his lifetime. They're still trickling in.
And you're saying dozens, scores a day sometimes.
Exactly. After longhand, maybe 40 or 50 manuscript writing pages. But what emerges from the... Oh, I remember I asked when I went out to the archive the first time, I asked one of the editors, how can you still be doing this after... You know, you've been here for 26 years, and you've what the editor said to me was, he never gets boring. I never grow tired of reading him. And as I moved through the book, I realized how true that was. The more you read of him, the more you want, the more you love of him, because the voice is endlessly rich and fascinating and suggestive.
Ron Powers, let us follow that vein right into this life, because we don't want to lose the chance to get that fabric that you've brought to life here, and it's really terrific. There's a bunch of people I want to ask about in his life, but let me first ask you about this sitting out of the Civil War. How deliberate was that? Was he a draft dodger? He grew up in Missouri. There was a lot of war in Missouri. Why was Mark Twain on the other side of the continent during the war?
Well, he literally was a draft dodger. He was a steamboat pilot until a Union cannonball sailed across the bow of one of the steamboats. It was the last boat to have free travel up the Mississippi before it was sealed off by the Union at the outset of the Civil War. He was terrified of being conscripted by either the North or the South, both of whom were looking for and really combing the streets.
Press gangs in Missouri.
I beg your pardon?
Press gangs nearly in Missouri.
Press gangs, exactly. So he escaped. He went back. He hid out in St. Louis for a while, then went up to his boyhood home of Hannibal, where he fell in with a bunch of slapdash would-be soldiers. They called themselves the Marion Rangers, and they crashed around the underbrush for two or three weeks until they got chased by a force led by an up-and-coming officer named Ulysses S. Grant, who, as you know, becomes an important force in Mark Twain's life in later years. Mm-hmm. So then Orion, his brother, gets an appointment to be the secretary of the Nevada Territory. And Sam hitches a ride with him, pays the stagecoach freight, and lo and behold, they fetch up in Carson City, and then they make it to Virginia City, where the territorial enterprise is. And he does sit out the Civil War in this counter-cultural environment, developing his voice, and when the war is over, he's ready to write.
Help us see him through a few other people. One, the brother who died and the guilt he carried about that.
Well, that would be Henry. I don't think enough is known or understood about the traumatic effect on Sam of Henry's death in a steamboat explosion in about 1857. Henry was a younger brother, beautiful, beautiful young man. Photographs show an almost Byronic face, gentle, sort of bookish, Sam wanted to get him up and out into the larger world, so he got him a position on as a mud clerk, like an intern, on the Steamboat Pennsylvania. And they made several trips up and down the river. The Pennsylvania was run by a tyrant named Brown, who took it upon himself to pick out Henry as a target because Henry was so vulnerable. Accused him of not carrying out an order. Sam knew it was a false accusation. He stood between his brother and Brown and said, "You lie, sir." Mm-hmm. That resulted in one of the two only physical fights we know of. Sam and Brown were grappling on the pilot house floor while the boat was drifting down the river with nobody at the wheel. Mm-hmm. The point is that when they got to New Orleans, it was clear that Sam could not go back upriver on the same boat as Brown, but Henry did. Mm. So the Pennsylvania leaves the dock at New Orleans and heads upriver. Sam is on a following boat. He began around Arkansas. He begins to hear the news of a steamboat explosion. Then they see the corpses in the water and the debris. In Tennessee, he rushes to the bedside of Henry, who was badly scalded and is dying, and in fact does die. And the wailing, the emotion, the outpouring of grief and guilt in his letters tell you that, in a way, this was the end of his boyhood. It was the end of his religion and the end of his capacity to think in a free and optimistic way about the world ever since.
And we certainly read the ghost of that brother and that change in the rest of his work. Laura Wright, the young girl in New Orleans, so much in the news today. You speak of corpses in the water, but here was a beautiful young girl. He knew her scarcely at all, saw her scarcely at all, and yet a presence for his entire life. Bring her to life.
Well, she was part of the same opera that involved Henry's death. It's an amazing, saga in and of itself. On that same docking at the New Orleans port where he changed boats, he recognized a riverboat next to the Pennsylvania called the John J. Roe. Mm. And he knew these people. He jumped aboard, and the first face he saw was that of a beautiful 14-year-old girl named Laura Wright, who was on her first visit downriver with her father.
Clemens was 20-something at that time.
Clemens was 22. Always, always rapturously infatuated with various women. And it was a beautiful interlude. He wrote that for the ensuing 3 days, he was not an inch from the girl's side, stipulating that it was daylight hours only. Mm. They separate. He goes back upriver. And the terrible accident occurs that destroys his faith. But he keeps in contact with Laura. He's stricken with her. He makes a trip to Warsaw, Missouri to court her. Her mother doesn't like him, and that is interrupted. But the figure of Laura and her kind of shimmering purity trail through his literature. She's probably part of Laura Hawkins in Tom Sawyer. There's a Laura in The Gilded Age, and she's always, I think he called her his beautiful Eidolon of regret. Mm-hmm. And the interesting story there is communication between them as the years go on.
But we can't read it today because she ultimately,
That's right.
As the letters burn.
In 1880, a schoolboy from Texas named Waddy Bowser writes to Mark Twain and says, I'm assigned to write an essay about the man I would most like to be, sir, and I would like to write about you. Would you be a boy all over again? And then, P.S., my teacher thinks she once knew you. Her name is Laura. Now it was Laura Dake. That was the first contact after the river. Then she writes him again in 1907 when she's an old woman. She's penniless. She asks him to send her money, and he does. Now, the great story that the world does not know, because the letter was only recently unearthed, is that Laura resurfaces 15 years after Sam's death in Hollywood, of all places. A 14-year-old girl on a Mississippi riverboat in Hollywood. A friend of the family takes her to a nightclub for her 80th birthday. She takes him back to the house, and she shows him a trunk full of letters that Sam had written her from Nevada during the Civil War, and he reads them. And Laura says, "But he made me promise on my honor that I would burn these letters, and Mr. Wright, I would like for you to do that." Mr. Wright, unfortunately, was a gentleman of his word, and those letters were destroyed.
Jack Beatty.
And with it, a lot of insight into his romantic life.
It's just unbelievable. Jack, the story of Twain, the romantic, and then the years roll by. Letters go up in smoke. We have the romantic. We have the embittered Twain. We have the tragic Twain.
We do. Son died, daughter died, another daughter had epilepsy, and of course, his wife predeceased him, but he lives. Gertrude Stein said, "Remarks aren't literature," but you wouldn't know it reading Mark Twain.
Yeah.
"A Frenchman's home is where another man's wife is." of the Senate, whiskey taking into committee rooms in demijohns and carried out in demagogues. On the Holy Land, no second advent. Christ's been here once, will never come again.
Oh, my gosh. I want to begin to turn to our callers. George is calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. George, you're on the air.
Oh, thank you very much. I believe that every time our country gets involved in a foreign intervention, we should read the war prayer from every pulpit.
Absolutely.
And what does it say to you, what does it say to you, George, that prayer?
Well, here's some of it. "O Lord our God, help us to tear their soldiers to bloody shreds with our shells. Help us to cover their smiling fields with the pale forms of their patriot dead. Help us to drown the thunder of the guns with the shrieks of their wounded writhing in pain. Help us to lay waste their humble homes with a hurricane of fire. Help us to wring the hearts of their unoffending windows with unavailing grief, for our sakes who adore thee, Lord."
Mm. George, it's terrific. We thank you for calling in with it. And Ron Powers, I wish you'd give us the context for that. This written, these words put in the mouth, as I recall, of a Filipino priest by Twain.
That's right. Jack mentioned the imperialist writings a little earlier, and it's such an important thing to understand about Mark Twain, such an important era, because that part of his life, the last 10 years, were really suppressed by his literary executor and his surviving daughter because they wanted to preserve that avuncular, nice man telling stories about boys playing hooky.
Mm-hmm.
In so many ways, Mark Twain was a prophet of the 20th century in pop cultural styles, in idioms, and certainly in politics. The war prayer. He came back to America in 1900, October 1900, after a nearly 10-year exile because he was out of money. The Page typesetter had broken him.
This was his business venture. It didn't work. He went off to Europe and spent a decade there nearly.
He had invested the equivalent today of something like $30 million in a machine that didn't work. So he comes back in October 1900. 2 years earlier, the United States had jumped onto the global stage. It had wiped the Spanish colonists out of Cuba. Good thing. Then it went over to the Philippines, the American armies, and evicted the Spanish from the Philippines, then turned on the very people it had gone there to protect, the Cuban patriots, the first Philippine
The Filipino patriots. Yes.
And suddenly war fever was abroad in the country. The Hearst papers were railing about it. Ministers were proclaiming that the Anglo-Saxon race was the great race of history, superior to the races in the warmer climates. One minister in New York, this may sound familiar to modern-day ears, declared that God is using the Anglo-Saxons to conquer the world for Christ by disposing feeble races and assimilating and molding others. Sounds a lot like we should invade their countries, kill their leaders, and convert them to Christianity. Rudyard Kipling was thundering about the white man's burden, and the progressives, the dissenters, were struck dumb. They didn't dare raise their voices. They would be branded as traitors. A man wrote a book saying, talking about the backstabbing of the anti-imperialist.
Ron Powers, we'll have to take a short break here. We want to come back and get Mark Twain's response to that imperial moment. century ago. Ron Powers, author of the new biography, Mark Twain, A Life. You can join our conversation, Can You Imagine? Mark Twain on Katrina and her aftermath, on George W. Bush, on our adventure in Iraq. 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Support for On Point comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Information is available at Bicon.com, B-I-C-O-N.com, and Private Wealth Management at Babson Capital. For more than 60 years, helping clients build and preserve wealth through financial planning, investment management, and trust services. In Cambridge and on the web at BabsonCapital.com.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the life and the great flood of genius in the work of Mark Twain and the life of Mark Twain. My guest is Ron Powers. He's author of the big new biography of Twain, Mark Twain, A Life. You can join us as well. What is it that still makes Mark Twain speak so deeply, so bitingly to and for Americans? And what is the great Mark Twain book or passage that you go back to? What would Twain have to say about his country and its ways today? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Ron Powers, you had us at that moment a century ago when the U.S. was taking its big imperial turn in the Philippines, went to throw out the oppressor, ended up making the Philippines into a colony, and Mark Twain had to say what?
Right, and the Jingo guys had the whole stage to themselves, and there wasn't very much dissent at all. There was a sense of as in more recent times, of being afraid to speak out. Mark Twain hits New York Harbor on October 15th, 1900. The Minnehaha has carried him and his family back home from London, and he walks down the gangplank, and there is a cluster of reporters waiting for him. There's always reporters waiting to interview him, And he wasted no time, and he minced no words. He said, "I am an anti-imperialist." He said, I am opposed to having the eagle put its talons on any other land." Nobody had spoken in this kind of muscular language before. And he went on. He said, "We were to relieve the Filipinos from Spanish tyranny to enable them to set up a government of their own. That would be a worthy mission for the United States." And now he uses the word that has come back to haunt people in our lifetimes, people in our generation. He said, "But now, why, we have gotten into a mess, a quagmire." He says, "A quagmire from which each fresh step renders the difficulty of extrication immediately greater." And he goes on, he finishes, he says, "I'm sure I wish I could see what we are getting out of it and all that it means to us as a nation." To which we in our time could answer back, "Sam, you really don't want to know."
But let me ask you, Ron Powers, how was that received? You say this was a time when there was a great public enthusiasm for this American undertaking. Here's Twain, as you said earlier, a draft dodger in the Civil War, an exile from the country for 10 years. He steps off the Minnehaha and belts it right out. Was he welcomed as the kindly genius Mark Twain, or was he, I don't know, was he condemned for it?
Well, he was. He was condemned for it. He was also celebrated for it. A lot of newspapers, including his hometown Hartford newspaper, took him to task for being a comedian out of his depth. And how dare he even dare to pronounce on these great matters of state. But he did earn a following, and he did manage to, in the last 10 years of his life, to write a number of essays that really have stood the test of time, including the war prayer that George, our caller, mentioned, "To a Person Sitting in Darkness," an ageless satire on the hypocrisy and the brutality of American foreign policy back then. He went on. He didn't stop there. He wrote an essay called "The United States of Lynchardom" after realizing that they were still lynching black people in his home state of Missouri. And he started writing about, in great opposition to all of the currents that were stirring that would lead up to World War I. Did it have an effect? Not the effect that we would like it to have had, although I think the war prayer has resurfaced on the internet in the past few years, and it has given a kind of articulation to people who are opposing American foreign policy now.
Let's turn to our callers again, if I may. Mark is calling from Grand Rapids, Michigan. Hi, Mark. You're on the air.
Hi. I read a book by Twain called The Mysterious Stranger, which really shocked me in that it didn't seem to fit with anything else I've read about him, and I really love Twain and have followed him all my life. And I'm wondering what that book meant in terms of when he wrote it in his life and what it might have represented in terms of his religious thinking and so on.
Thanks, Mark. Ron Powers?
I'd like to hear Jack on this, too. My feeling is that he was working out for maybe the last time in his life his complicated and tortured relationship to the Christian faith and even to the presence of a God. I think that faith had been shattered, as I say, with Henry's death on the river. It had taken a lot more blows in his time. I think he always approached religion, the Christian God, as kind of from the vantage point of a jilted lover. He wanted to believe, but he couldn't believe based on what he'd seen in the world. So the mysterious stranger is a figure who enters the life of a small town and puts human nature to the test by announcing that there is gold to be found if you did this and such and write this and such kind of letter. And it turns out, actually, I'm talking about the man that corrupted Hadleyburg right now. The mysterious stranger is the devil who appears in the guise of a young boy and who is quite attractive to the people in the village and seems to have a corner on morality. And that, I think, is Mark Twain's maybe final statement on that idea.
Jack Beatty?
The Prince of Darkness is a gentleman. Did Twain say that? I think he did. Yes, I mean, this character of Satan, he loved to catch him, to sort of cast himself in that voice, rather the way Milton does in Paradise Lost. And he assures his wife, as she's dying, that he's thinking better of the idea of immortality, yet he also writes, one of the proofs of immortality of the soul is that myriads have believed it. They also believe the world was flat.
There we go. Ned is calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Ned, you're on the air.
Yes, you were asking a question about how Twain might respond to the tragedy of Katrina in New Orleans at this point. And I believe if you look at Connecticut Yankee and King Arthur's Court, it's a great wellspring of information about what Twain might have to say about a number of things, social mores, Yankee industriousness, political infighting. But in one episode, Arthur takes to the countryside the better to learn about his countrymen. And in the course of this, he encounters plague throughout the countryside. And contrary to advice he has given, he declines that advice and waltzes right into this. He wades right into this, and he shows great compassion in terms of his approach to his suffering countrymen and subjects. So I think that might give us a clue as to what Twain might say about the current status of leadership in this country regarding Katrina.
The leader wading right into the midst of plague. Of course, Ron Powers, George Bush has been repeatedly back to New Orleans in the Gulf Coast in the last 10 days. I see maybe one of the heirs, though, of Mark Twain, Maureen Dowd, in the New York Times, saying the president should stop haunting New Orleans, looking for that bullhorn moment. It's too late. I hear that biting humor of Twain alive even there. But what about this moment? It's his river. New Orleans is a town he knew well and returned to later in his life quite significantly as well on that long return trip to Hannibal and the Mississippi. His sense of that place, of the tragic around that that slave part of the country, about the role of leaders?
Well, he was always entranced by New Orleans. He found it a kind of, as many people have, a mystical place where the dead lie in coffins above the water and fortune tellers abound. He had his fortune told by a Madame Caprell, and she mentioned Laura Wright to him. He loved the sensuousness of it. I don't think that his experiences in New Orleans were early enough in his life that he really hadn't begun to form a political ideology. He never did form an ideology, but political beliefs. So I think, though, that he would have recognized, and he would have seen the metaphor in the flood that was visited on New Orleans.
I wish you'd take us back to this quite wonderful moment. He's deep in midlife. It's 20 years or so after the moment when he first comes east to Howells, who had written, there is an amount of pure human nature in the book that rarely gets into literature, that from his one of his very earliest works. But now he had gotten kind of stuck in life, and he came back to the river. I just loved how you described that. He hadn't been back for a long time, to the Mississippi, to Hannibal, to Cairo, and right on down. This is turf I know very well. His description, standing on a steamboat of that morning sunrise that he dictated, I was struck at how it seemed as though he tried to capture everything that flowed through his mind. He dictated to Mr. Phelps standing by him.
He did.
Birds singing here at sunrise, foliage green in the distance, walls of forest near at hand, and right on. What was he back into the great Mississippi Valley for then?
Well, I think he was, at that time, he was replenishing his faith in being alive. I think his money anxieties had started to really mount. He had the big house in Hartford. He'd spent, something like $300,000 on the house. He was investing in all kinds of things that were not going to work out for him, and he was a beleaguered businessman. So he had been trying to get Howells to go to the Mississippi with him for years and years, and Howells never quite could make it. It would have been a wonderful pairing. So he takes his publisher, James Osgood, and the stenographer, Mr. Phelps, and they return to the river in April of 1882. He steps on a boat, and he slips into the river, and it all becomes sensuous again. I mean, he's that passage you mentioned a moment ago. He's standing on the deck at 4 o'clock in the morning, and they're heading for Kentucky Bend aboard the Gold Dose, the gold dust. And he writes to Livy later, "Birds singing here at sunrise, foliage green in the distance, walls of forest near at hand, paling gradually with the distance and vanishing. The first blush of the spring sun on the outflow was pink, then purple, and the reflections in the water still beautiful." And that becomes, he feeds that later into the most beautiful single passage he ever wrote, the sunrise chapter that begins, the sunrise section that begins chapter 19 of Huckleberry Finn. Harold Bloom has called it the most beautiful prose paragraph yet written by an American.
And you can hear it right there in his dictation, which you capture to Mr. Phelps on the deck of that boat. You've got a passage also about his longing for that boyhood on the river that so many Americans know or think they know so well through Tom Sawyer and Huckleberry Finn. It's on page 440. I wonder if you could read a bit of that for us.
I have a book right in front of me, and let me turn to that page 440.
This is Twain, not the embittered Twain exactly, certainly not not the war prayer Twain, but the one looking back to the golden boyhood.
Well, it's he's answering Waddy Bowser, the schoolboy who wrote asking him if he would change places, if he could, if he would be a boy again. And would he live his life over again? And Sam writes back, "Would I live it over again under certain conditions? Certainly I would. The main condition would be that I should emerge from boyhood as a cub pilot on a Mississippi boat, and that I should by and by become a pilot and remain one. The minor conditions would be these. Summer always. The magnolias at Rifle Point always in bloom, so that the dreamy twilight should have the added charm of their perfume. The oleanders always in bloom likewise. The sugar canes always green." And I think it was the idea that he really was communicating with his childhood sweetheart, Laura. Right, he was using Waddy as an intermediary. He was writing, I think, a kind of love letter to this former 14-year-old girl who he'd met in the great operatic saga of his life on the Mississippi.
Jack, that's incredible. Young Waddy Bowser writes to Mark Twain and gets that in the correspondence that comes back.
Right.
Holy smokes. But Jack, you and I were talking earlier about the anger in Twain, the other side, not that golden glow, not the oleander in bloom, but how anger seemed a constant presence in his life and drove him. What catches your eye there, Jack Beatty?
Well, you know, as Ron shows, his very first published squib was a satire, a hit on a personage of Hannibal. And, you know, when I look at him, I'm reminded of Dickens, and I'm reminded of Lyndon Johnson and others, men who had feckless fathers who died on him. and who took into life a kind of will to succeed, almost titanic will to succeed, that knew no obstacles, and that also filled them with a tremendous anger. They at once accepted the values of the father, and really loathed the father's failure to make it go of it. And that's a pretty heady brew, it seems to me, to have in a young man's sails. And I'm not suggesting that fathers should die young out there, but it seems to have helped some young men.
Ron Powers, I know it's not a psychoanalysis you're doing here, but what about that anger and the route Jack looks to?
Well, William Dean Howells is our most reliable guide. He knew Clemens for 40 years and saw him very perceptively. And it was Howells who recognized that the anger was essential to Mark Twain's literature. He said the indignant sense of right and wrong, an ardent hate of meanness and injustice. But it wasn't unfair. Howells never felt that the anger was necessarily unfair. If you were his friend, he would be loyal to you forever. If you crossed him, God help you. Howells said Clemens didn't even forgive his dead enemies. Their death seemed to deepen their crimes like a base evasion or a cowardly attempt to escape. He pursued them to the grave. He would like to dig them up and take vengeance upon their clay. Oh, that's a pretty good description of anger.
Do not cross this man. We've just got a couple of minutes left. You end up calling Mark Twain for all the ways we can look at him. Among them, you say he was the first American rock star or celebrity. Was he very conscious of that? Did he make the mold for that status?
He wasn't conscious at first, but when he learned it, he really learned how to play it. And I know that rock star sounds frivolous, but I really do believe I can back it up, because he did anticipate so many things that we take for granted in the culture. When he walked out onto the lecture stage, he would sweep the audience with his eyes. He would make eye contact. He would make an intimate connection with each member of that sitting in the audience, or seemed to.
And he knew that made a crackle. He learned that from the experience.
And he did, and he had this preternaturally slow drawl, Sammy's long talk, his mother called it. And that pause, that hesitation would build enormous tension, and the audience would sit there wondering how he was going to break it, what the snapper would be. And when it came, and often it was rather shocking, rather coarse by 19th century standards, the place would go up for grabs. Women were attracted to him. They would murmur to one another that, oh, I cannot like him too much now that his wife has borne him another child. And he called himself the Vandal. He went on a lecturing tour as the Vandal. He staged another lecture tour called The Twins of Genius with a Southern novelist named George Washington Cable. And the point is, he was the first 19th century man of the stage to be interesting not for what he was saying, but for the fact that he stood on the stage and seduced you. And that is the essence of the rock star.
We're seduced from the stage and from the prose. We're very grateful to you, Ron Powers, for the new biography, Mark Twain, A Life, and for your time with us this hour. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.
And Jack Beatty, always great to have you. Thanks for joining us this hour.
Thank you.
We'll go out with the overture from Mark Twain's World, composed by Christopher Rubeck. We've heard it through this hour, performed and commissioned by the Stockton Symphony here. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.